Ready?
Yes, ma'am. Okay.
Yeah, no, let's examine it. It's about 20.
Okay.
I thought maybe I'll speak a little bit about Hanukkah just to begin with.
Go right ahead.
Okay. I thought since it's Hanukkah, I'd speak a little bit about the holiday of Hanukkah at first. And the holiday of Hanukkah is unique because it's a celebration of a victory, a great victory that the Maccabees brought about against the Greeks. And I just want to mention the main idea of that celebration. The main idea of the celebration is, interestingly enough, that there is only one hero, and that hero is God. It's interesting that when we read the prayers that speak about the victory, the prayers do not state that the Maccabees were powerful warriors. It states exactly the opposite. The prayer states that we say, because of the miracles, we thank God because of the miracles and the redemption and the great victories and the wars which you have done for our fathers in those days at this time. And then it goes on to describe the Kohen Gadol, which was Matthias and Mattathias. And then it says that the Greek government wished to cause the people of Israel to forget the Torah and to violate the laws. And then it says, you with your kindness stood by them in their time of troubles. And you were the one that waged their war, and you took their revenge. You gave strong, powerful people over into the hands of weak people. So it really refers to the ones that did battle, they referred to as weak people. And many, which is the Greeks, gave over in the hands of the few. Again, the few refers to the Maccabees. So the Maccabees are referred to as weak, as few. And the entire prayer really just states one thing, that the we thank God exclusively for the victory. And it's interesting, but unfortunately in Israel today, although everyone celebrates the holiday of Hanukkah, it's celebrated in two ways. The religious Jews celebrated the way I mentioned, that the praise is given to God totally, and the Maccabees are really viewed as not as great warriors, but on the contrary, as weak in terms of the their physical power, and we ascribe the victory to God. Whereas the Jews that are non-religious, they make it into a nationalistic kind of holiday where the Maccabees are viewed as great heroes. Now, it's interesting, but in Torah philosophy, you should know that we really have no heroes, and that's really a theme of Torah. The only hero is God, and this is really basic philosophy of Torah. Torah never idolizes any human being. That's why if you read the Bible, people are always struck by the fact that when you read the Bible, how honest the Torah is about its heroic figures. And the reason is because we do not project any real heroism onto these people. Heroism is an idealization and an idolization of people, of man. And Torah is realistic. Torah states the great people's merits, their shortcomings, and the only hero that we have is God. So this is the philosophy of Torah. Those who are non-religious, they attach themselves to the holiday, strangely enough, because they make it into a nationalistic event, and they're proud of their great warriors of the past. But what I want to point out is that there is a contradiction in this type of thinking, because in truth, you cannot separate a hero from his cause. The fact that people are often impressed with the fact that somebody or some group of people gave their lives for something. This is always very impressive kind of thing. Well, if they gave their lives, then they were really great people. But in Torah, we don't look at it that way. There are many Nazis that gave their lives for Hitler and for Nazism. These are not heroes. These were sick, demented people and evil people. So the fact that a person is willing to give their life does not make them a hero. The hero cannot be separated from his cause. If the hero is just and his cause is just, then he gives his life, then that reflects that is a great person. But to just say a person is great, and people are always very impressed by the fact that, well, they gave their lives for this. It could be. The only question is, was this really a just cause? Is this really something great that they gave their, or these people that had knowledge, true knowledge, and gave their lives something worthwhile, or was it just an emotion to give their lives, to throw their lives away? That we don't consider as heroic. Now, what's strange about the celebration of Hanukkah when it's done on a secular level, that is, a non-religious level, it really is somewhat of a contradiction, because these people, the Maccabees, who really put their lives at risk, and they died also later because of it in battle, they really were only doing it for one reason. They were only doing it for God and for Torah, and in order to be able to keep the commandments. Now, if a person is a secular individual and considers this to be foolish, then, on the contrary, these shouldn't be considered heroes. These should be considered foolish people. You can only consider these people heroes if you consider their cause. You can't, as I said before. So if a person just believes that these individuals were great warriors and fantastic fighters and genius militarists, if that's what the person thinks, then the person is really at odds with their own heroes, because these people really only did it for one purpose, and that was in order to be able to keep the Torah. If you do not believe in Torah, then you must consider these people as being foolish. If they're foolish, then you really shouldn't respect them even as heroes. So there is a contradiction, actually, in terms. When you celebrate Hanukkah in a secular way, it cannot be celebrated in a secular way. The Torah itself is actually very anti-nationalism. Because you see in Deuteronomy how Moses tells the people that Moses tells them in Deuteronomy 8, 14, excuse me, 8, 17. And you'll say in your heart, my strength and the strength of my hand created for me this army. So then the next verse says, you should remember the God your God, because he's the one that gives you strength to create an army, in order that he could fulfill his covenant that he swore to your fathers as this day. So the Torah is very much against the idea of man feeling nationalistic pride. As a matter of fact, the Moses goes out of his way to mention several times that the people should not have pride in themselves, both from a physical aspect, both in a physical way, and in a spiritual way even. Because he says in Deuteronomy 7:7, he says that it's not because you were so plentiful, that you were so numerous, that you were the most numerous of all the nations, that God loves you. Because you really were the smallest of all the nations, which means to say that you shouldn't consider yourself as being a great nation from a physical standpoint. And then he goes on to say the only reason is because God loves you, because of the keeping of the vow which he vowed to your fathers, to your forefathers, that means the patriarchs. That's why he took you out of the land of Egypt. Then again he says in Deuteronomy 8, 9:4, you shouldn't say in your heart, when God chases out the other nations, that it's because of my righteousness that God brought me to this land, and because of the evil of these nations, the evil doings of these nations. In other words, that I am righteous and they are evil. I am better than they. So he says, no, it's not because of your righteousness, but because of it's true that these nations were evil and that's why they deserve to be removed. But the reason is in order to fulfill, the reason God did it is in order to fulfill the vow that he vowed again, that he vowed to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. So Moses makes it quite clear to the people that they should not have any sense of nationalistic arrogance and egoism, but they should realize that this is God's plan, that he's and they're a part of his they're a part of his plan, but it's not because of their own righteousness or because of their own physical properties as a nation. So the Torah is very cautious, cautious about that. That man should not become arrogant and get involved in nationalistic emotions. And that is why on Hanukkah, when we celebrate Hanukkah, we don't even mention, as a matter of fact, we don't even mention Judah HaMaccabee, who was the main figure in the battle. We say that it was done, that God did these miracles, and we mention through his holy priests, through those individuals, because they were priests, they were Kohanim, they were priests. But that's mentioned parenthetically. But the focus is always on the fact that God is the one that brought the victory, and he is the only one that a human being's emotions of heroism should be attached to. And that's basically the... I would say that what the essential message of Hanukkah is, that the only hero is God, and that's really the message. So I just wanted to give you just a brief idea of Hanukkah before we go back to the Talmud, unless you have some questions. If anybody has any questions, I'll be glad to answer them. Are there any?
I don't believe there is. I believe you can continue.
Okay. Okay, now let's return to the Talmud. We're doing the tractate of Sanhedrin, and we're on in the Mishnah, and we're on page 56. Okay, now we spoke about the fact that which we call Birkas Hashem, one of the seven laws of Noah, and that is the prohibition against cursing God. And now the Talmud is going to go through a very thorough analysis of what exactly this is. And when we get finished, we'll have an understanding of what exactly it is structurally, halachically, and also philosophically. All right? Now, we're in the Mishnah on 56a, where it says, on each day they would judge the witnesses, and you see... they would judge the witnesses, and it says they would judge judge is the word in Hebrew. They would interrogate the witnesses. Okay, they would interrogate the witnesses each day, and they wouldn't use God's name, however, because of the fact that one is not permitted to utter the curse. So since one is not permitted to utter the curse, so the based in the Sanhedrin, when dealing with this case, had a unique hardship that did not exist in any other case, and that is they could not verbalize what the defendant was being accused of. Okay, they couldn't verbalize it because the verbalization itself is a violation. One is not permitted to make that statement, and so therefore they would use another word in place of God's name. And the word that they would use in place of God's name is Josi. And there's a reason why they use Josi. So Josi, whenever we continue, Josi stands for God's name. Now, the reason why they use Josi is because it is similar to God's name in two respects. Okay, Rashi explains that, first of all, it has four letters, just like the ineffable name of God, which has four letters. And secondly, the second reason is that when you add up the letters, when you add up the numerical value of Josi in Hebrew, comes out to the same numerical value as Elohim. I'm not, you know, the end of that The third syllable of that is him. So there are three syllables, air, low, and the last syllable is him. But I always say kim because you're not permitted to pronounce God's name, even though that's not the ineffable name, but you're not allowed to pronounce it just for no reason at all. So when I say Elohim, you'll know that that's what I mean. Now, the reason why they used Joseph is because of two reasons Rashi explains. First of all, it's similar to the ineffable name. It has four letters. And secondly, the numerical value equals God. God Almighty. Elohim means Almighty, All-Powerful. So according to Rashi, even though they did not use God's name, they had to use a name which had the characteristics of God's name. In other words, it was an appearance that had four letters, and also the numerical value equals God. So according to Rashi, that's why they used that word Josi. So in other words, when they would say, what did this man do, what did he say actually, so they would say, he said, Josi should smite Josi. Okay? Or should destroy Josie. All right? So they, instead of saying God's name. Now the Mishnah explains what happened, okay? And I'll just translate first, then we'll explain it a little further. It says, on every day, they would interrogate the witnesses with the name Josie. So they would interrogate, what did you hear? Well, we heard this man say that Josie should destroy Josie, okay? Now, I can't translate that for you. You have to remember, because I can't enunciate this thing. Even if I use the word God, it would be improper. So you understand what I mean. Now, then the Mishnah continues and says, once they got finished with the process of deliberation of the court, then they could not kill him. They could not kill this person if he was actually fit to be put to death. In other words, he was criminally guilty. But what would they do? They would take everyone and move everybody from the court. And they would ask the Sanhedrin alone was there, and they would ask the witness who was the most knowledgeable, the most scholarly, the greatest among the witnesses, the most intelligent, the main witness. And they would say to him, say exactly what did you hear openly, state it openly. And then he would state the curse that he heard with God's name. Okay? And then the judges would stand up and they would rent their garments when they heard it. And then the second witness would say, they'd ask him and he'd say, I also heard the same thing as this other person. As this other witness. In other words, ditto. I heard the same thing. And the third one would say, if there were three, then each one, you know, then the third one, etc., etc. As many witnesses as there were would say, I heard what this first person enunciated. But they would not repeat that statement. Only one would make that statement. Okay, now we're going to see that every step here has to be analyzed. Now, first of all, we have to understand that there are really three processes, three in a court, in the Sanhedrin, when they adjudicated, what they did was they were three components to the process, to the legal process. First, there was the acceptance of the testimony of the witnesses. That's process one. All right. Then you have what we call, in Hebrew, it's called Masa Matan. Masa Matan means that the judges would analyze. They would analyze, talk among themselves. Sometimes they'd break up into pairs, and they would discuss the case, all aspects of the case. Of course, the aspects of the case is to interrogate the witnesses, to make sure that everything is correct and accurate. And then once they knew the facts from the witnesses, but then there was still more to discuss, because they would have to discuss the very halacha itself. Maybe there's a way that we could say that this person really didn't commit the sin, according to halacha. Maybe he didn't do it properly. Maybe there's something missing. And this would require lengthy analysis and discussion. Now, everything here was done, by the way, with extreme caution. The witnesses were taken before the Sanhedrin, and they would frighten them, so to speak. They would tell them how serious a matter they were involved in, and they would speak about how every life is valuable, and how they would speak about the how in God's eyes every human being's life is valuable, and they would impress them emotionally with the importance of the significance of human life, and how cautious and how important it is that the testimony be accurate. And then they would do this to each one of the witnesses. A lot of times they would move them from place to place, sometimes just to have them to make sure that, you know, that they don't change their testimony under different circumstances, just the psychological tactics that they would use. And then they would interrogate them independently. In other words, they would interrogate witness A independently and go through a whole series of questions. And of course, he's speaking about brilliant men on the Sanhedrin. No one was on the Sanhedrin. No fool could be on the Sanhedrin. These are the greatest minds of the nation. And they would interrogate each witness carefully and at length. Then they would dismiss that witness and interrogate another one separately, asking questions that involved precisely what took place, details. If A killed B, well, what was A wearing? You know, all different kinds of questions. And the details were very important. Then they would, if there were more witnesses, they would interrogate that, the third witness and the fourth, etc., etc. Then if there was any discrepancy in the testimonies, that was it. It's very difficult, really. That's why they say that a Sanhedrin that killed somebody once in 70 years was considered a killer Sanhedrin, because it was very difficult, really, to be able to execute somebody, since the requirements were so strict. You could not accept, I have to laugh when I look at the court system that we have here, because testimony from anyone is acceptable, even a criminal. I mean, in Sanhedrin, the only one that could be accepted as a valid witness was a person that we knew lived an upright life. Anyone that was a crook, a criminal, his testimony is worthless. Again, testimony of relatives is worthless. And then even a person who lived an upright life, we know that he's this man, has a record of in his community, he's an upright individual, has never been involved in anything which is illegal or anything like that. Even then, we question him, and we question him apart from the other. It was not only a cross-examination, it was a double cross-examination, because you cross-examine the witness, and then you dismiss him, and you cross-examine the next witness. Now, if this was a story that was made up by these witnesses, it would be very hard for them to get through the cross-examination of Sanhedrin on every detail, details which it would be almost impossible for them to have planned this in advance, every single detail, and that they should corroborate each other on every single detail. It was very, very difficult to get through this extensive interrogation. And if there was any discrepancy, it was dismissed. So, and this was done by the most brilliant people in the country, I mean, in the society, in the people, among the people. And they knew very well how to question, and the way he had a question, and to make sure when they questioned that the witness should not be able to sense which way to go. They're very wise and clever, and they knew exactly what they were doing. It would be almost impossible for people to get through such a very thorough investigation. And then after the witnesses were thoroughly interrogated, and if it turns out after that their testimony is the same, Then what they do is, then they had those facts, then they would go into the halachic issues and to see whether to discuss the halacha to make sure precisely that the way the man committed the crime is really truly deserving of the most severe penalty. So, and what they would do during that time is, if, for instance, on the first day, if the man was found innocent, so then he was dismissed, of course. The defendant was dismissed. If he wasn't found innocent on the first day, then they went at it another day, and they were not permitted to drink any intoxicating beverages during that time, and they did not eat much, just enough to, you know, not to, to stave off the hunger. And they would be involved in discussing the case all day and through the night, and then the on the third morning they would convene, and each one would give his vote, and it went by majority rule. So this was a very, very strict and thorough system that was used. Now, getting back to the components of the case, again, we have three components. You have the testimony of the witnesses, okay? Then, two, you have the discussion between the members of the Sanhedrin, analysis of the case, discussion as to the details. It could be anything, actually, besides the halacha itself, of course, and also anything about the case, any details, maybe some questions. What happened? What did he do at this point? What did this witness say over here? What did that witness say? Are the witnesses definitely 100% corroborated? There's no contradiction. There's no conflict here. And it was extremely, as I said, an extremely thorough discussion between the scholars of the Sanhedrin about the case. And so the second component was discussion. First component was the testimony of the witnesses. Second component was discussion. And the third component of the justice system, of the court system, was to render a verdict. And that was done by having the whole Sanhedrin convene. And when they did, each one would place his vote, guilty or innocent. And it would go by majority. By the way, the Sanhedrin sat like in a semicircle. And the reason why they sat in a semicircle is that each one had a perfect view of the witnesses, the testimony, everything that went on. I noticed some universities use that idea, the semicircle idea. But the Sanhedrin had that was part of the halacha of the Sanhedrin, had to be in a semicircle, but everyone has a perfect view of what's going on. Also, the Sanhedrin would never accept any testimony in writing. It had to be only verbal. And it had to be, it could not be, one witness could not be attesting to what he heard from another witness. It had to be something he saw himself. And very rigid requirements, very rigid. That's why I say it was extremely difficult, really, to convict anybody, because the system was extremely thorough. And I mean, it is as flawless as humanly possible. Now, but let's get back to the three components, okay? So now we have to go back to this Mishnah and try to understand how the application of these three components takes place in the case, in this case, the case of the individual who blasphemes. All right? Okay, so the Mishnah states that during each day, I mean the days that the Sanhedrin is involved in analysis and in discussion, so if they questioned the Aiden, they interrogated the witnesses, they would not use God's name, but they would use Josie, as I mentioned before. But then it says before, if right before the conclusion of the case, if he were found guilty, so then they would have one of the witnesses state exactly what he heard using God's name. Okay? Now, we have to understand why this is so. I mean, if the use of God's name is necessary, so then it should have been done before. And if it's not necessary, why did it have to be done later? Apparently, they were able to go through all the days that are necessary for analysis and discussion. They were able to go through those days without mentioning God's name. So why, at the end, was it necessary to mention God's name and to mention exactly what the witness heard? That's what we have to understand at this point. And now, in order to explain this, I have to take you for a moment to another area and explain a concept over there. And then when we understand the concept over there, we're going to apply it over here. Okay. Am I running towards the end of the tape?
Yes.
Okay.
We're going to make the turnover. Okay. I got a question.
According to Torah, you cannot be judged by your peers. The idea of being, I think in today's system, a serious problem. But for instance, if you're judged by 12 peers, now there are cases, and I myself have seen cases which were documented on television where they showed a jury that could not understand the case because the case was too complex. And they subsequently asked me, said, well, how did you come to a decision? So the jury said, well, we held hands and we prayed to God that we should do the right thing. And then they came to a verdict. Now, this is so absurd and so ridiculous. This is not justice. This is nonsense. And praying is very nice, but this is time to pray. This is not time to pray. This is time to use your mind and understand. The Torah likes prayer very much, but the Torah tells the person that there's a time to learn, to study, to understand, to have knowledge. You don't pray when somebody's life is at stake or you're passing a judgment on a judicial matter. What you do is you have to use your mind to understand it. If you don't understand it, then you should simply remove yourself from this position. You can't judge a case without your mind and without your intelligence. It doesn't make any sense. It's senseless. So the idea of being judged by your peers, which people like, perhaps it's the, I'm not going to argue American law because it's a different kind of a system, and the question is, what would you replace it with? The Torah system is God's system, and it operates in its own framework. Here you have different people with, a country that wants to create a justice system which is trying to avoid certain pitfalls that don't exist in the Torah system as a potential in the Torah system. And also you have different people with different views. So you have to satisfy, democracy has to satisfy everybody's whims and everybody's desires. So it's a different kind of a system. I'm not saying that I would present an alternative at this point. I mean, there would be a major study to analyze American law. But that's not my purpose here. What I'm trying to say is that the system is defective in the eyes of the Torah, and the fact that you do not have great scholars and men of knowledge and erudition who really know what is going on in the case. I mean, this is the foremost important. Also, the cross-examinations, the way it's done over here, every witness knows what the other witness says. That's not really a fair cross-examination. The way the cross-examination of the Torah is much superior because each witness is taken in...
Rabbi, I got another question when it's a good time to start.
What's that? A what?
I've got another question for you. I should have asked this on your beginning, but if you would, could you give us just a definition of what cursing God is, how broad it is, what it consists of or does not consist of? Does just saying something bad about God or limiting him or saying what he can't do, is that cursing God?
Okay.
And maybe just give us a general definition of what cursing God is.
Let me give you and that's what, when we get finished with this area, we're going to know exactly what it is, as I said before. We're on the way. But the basic description of cursing God is, and I'm just going to have to ask you to have a little what we call intellectual tolerance. In other words, just hold this in your mind. It's saying Josie should destroy Josie. Now, Josie is a word that we use in place of God, because I cannot make that statement, because if I'd make that statement, I myself would be a blasphemer. You follow what I'm saying? So therefore, the word Josie is used in place of God. All right? I'm not, you have to be careful when you, as a matter of fact, when you study this area, I told the fellows in Yeshiva, you have to be careful that you shouldn't say that, because you're not permitted to say that. You're not permitted to make the statement. So we always use Josie. Josie should destroy Josie. That's what he's saying, basically. Now, we're going to get into what kind of sense does that make, and why is that the form of the curse? Why is that the form of the violation of cursing God? All right, we're going to get into that in the Talmud, why that, and what exactly that means. But just to give you some kind of a handle on it, I may have mentioned this last time. If I did, I'll be a little repetitious then, but let me just say it again. The person who curses God is obviously a demented individual, okay? Why does the Torah deal with him in this way? Well, the answer is this. You see, a person who has the true idea of God can never, always construes God in terms of God, in terms of perfection. We ascribe perfection to God. Anyone that has any knowledge of God knows that God is the source of all perfection. Now, this person doesn't have that knowledge, obviously, if he's cursing. So he has a distorted notion of God. Now, we can tolerate people that have an emotional or distorted idea of God. We can tolerate such a thing. It's tolerable. But we cannot tolerate people that have an emotional idea of God and have a negative idea of God. You see, that's bad. And that's why if a person is reduced to that level, where not only don't they have a true concept of God, but their emotional concept of God involves a hatred against their idea of God, or it's a negative one, and they verbalize such a thing, such a statement, then this is considered a horror and a terrible thing, and this person must be removed from the society. Okay? This person must be removed from the society because this person can influence other people in the worst way, and giving them a wrong idea about God and showing utter disrespect for the idea of God. But the form of the curse is important, and we will see when we get to the Talmud precisely why that curse is that way. Okay? But that is the form of the curse. The person must say, Josie should destroy or should curse Josie. All right? So it really, in this curse, the curse is using God as the source of the curse, and it's also using God as the object of the curse. Do you follow what I mean? Okay. Now, let us continue.
I just going to respond. I think we understand a little bit now.
Okay, good. Thank you. So let us just continue. Now, we'll get to the Talmud is going to discuss all the possibilities of what it means to curse God. But this is the final description. Now, when we're talking about this process, this individual who made the statement, okay? So we, again, and the Sanhedrin over here were limited because they could not enunciate, verbalize what they were talking about, because that would constitute cursing on their part. And this statement cannot be made by any human being. The only time it was made was before they would enunciate the guilty verdict. Okay. And now the question is, why was it necessary then, and why wasn't it necessary before? That was the question that we raised a while back. Now, what I want to do again over here is to take you to another area. Let's forget about this area for a moment. Now let's take up another area, and I want to just go through a basic Talmudic concept. And once we master this concept, we'll see that this concept is very important in understanding what's going on over here. Okay, now we have an institution of marriage in Torah. Now, there's a difference between marriage for Ben Noach and marriage for Ben Israel. For Ben Noach, as you know, the marriage simply takes place through living together. With the Ben Israel, it is a formal transaction. All right, the formal transaction. The man gives the ring or the object that has minimal value, certain value, that's a minimal value, to the lady in the presence of two witnesses. All right, and the moment he does that, this woman is married to him. So it's a transaction, really. By the way, the transaction is not, it has nothing to do. That's why, you know, many people are against the idea of having a Jewish marriage in the synagogue, because they say that is following the ways of the goyim, of the Christians, because in the Torah view, the synagogue has nothing to do with it. It is simply a transaction. Transaction, and it has nothing to do. You see, in Christianity, the church wants to sanction the sexuality of the people, because they're in control of it, so to speak. So they want to sanction it. In Torah, there's no such concept. In Torah, sexuality is a normal process. And getting married is a normal process. And a man marries a woman, and the only reason we have a rabbi actually at the ceremony is not because the rabbi is a holy man. There's nothing to do with that. The only reason you have rabbis there is because the rabbi knows how the transaction should be done properly. And if it's not done properly, then there could be serious problems. So we have to know whether it was done, how it was done, to make sure it's done properly. But he's just there as a learned individual. It's not a kind of, it's a holy kind of thing. It's because the transaction must be guarded by someone who has knowledge of it. But getting back to this, the idea of marriage, the law of marriage, the marriage is done where the man gives an object that has worth and value, and the woman accepts this object. So he gives it to her, and she accepts it, and then they're married. Now, how do we know two people are married? The answer is witnesses. Okay? Now, let's say, for instance, two people get married privately, and they both come to the Sanhedrin, and they say, look, the man says, I gave this young lady this object, this ring, and she accepted it. And I told her before I gave it to her that with this ring, she's going to be married to me. And she accepted it. And we did this. But there were no witnesses, but we both admit that we did this. Would this be considered a marriage? And the answer is no. Why? Because in this case, witnesses are not there for verification. See, there's two kinds of witnesses. There are witnesses for verification, in other words, to tell us what happens. And then there are witnesses, sometimes, which are there because the process itself demands witnesses. In other words, marriage without witnesses is not considered marriage. So the witnesses aren't just present at a marriage because we need them to verify in case someone questions whether these two parties are married. We need these two witnesses to verify and to tell us that they got married. That's not the reason they're there. They're there for a more substantial reason. That's a good reason too, but they're there for a more substantial reason, and that is namely because a wedding without witnesses is worthless. Witnesses are a component of the scene. And if there are no witnesses there, then there is no wedding. If two people admit that they got married, it does not mean a thing. Since there were no witnesses there, it's worthless. The presence of witnesses is a necessary component of the marriage scene. So there is no marriage without witnesses. Just like there is no marriage without a ring, there is no marriage without a groom, there is no marriage without a bride, there's no marriage without witnesses. They are just as important in order to effectuate this change in the relationship, making the woman married, creating the marriage, in order to create the entity of the status of marriage, in order to create that status, you must have those witnesses there. Okay? That's one kind of witnesses. Now, another kind of witnesses, another reason they're there is, of course, in case we want to know if two people are married and two witnesses come and say, well, we saw them get married. Then the testimony is accepted, because two witnesses' testimony is always accepted. So witnesses over here serve a double function. They verify, and they're also a component. Sometimes we have witnesses which are just verification. For instance, if A lends B money, so then there are two witnesses there. Now, what do we need the witnesses for? We need the witnesses to know how much money A lent B, what are the terms of the loan, and when B has to repay the loan. Over here, the witnesses aren't necessary in order for B to be obligated to repay his loan. The loan will take place even if there are no witnesses. If A lends B money privately, he's still obligated. The only problem is that B could start saying, well, the terms aren't exactly as A says, and then you have a problem, and then you have to go to court, and each one's going to say what he thinks the case is, and unless you have witnesses, you can't clarify what exactly took place. So that's why the Talmud says you're not permitted to lend somebody money unless you have witnesses. Even though you're friends, because the Torah has a very deep knowledge of psychology, and it knows that human beings may be friends at one point, but then when time goes by, people tend to forget certain things that go against their own emotions, and certain conditions of loans are forgotten. In favor of the whoever, the forgotten condition is usually favors the person that forgets it. So this is a tendency that human beings have, and therefore the Torah says that it's a law of the Torah. Actually, you shouldn't lend a person money unless you have two witnesses, even if you're good friends, because you're not going to be good friends if you do this, because great difficulties are going to arise. So over here, you should have two witnesses whenever you lend somebody money. It's a good idea. Or the person can write a document. That's also just as good, as long as it's in writing and all the conditions are spelled out. But over here, the witnesses are only for verification. The witnesses aren't there in order to produce the loan, in other words, the obligation of the loan. The loan is produced by borrowing the money. So what we're showing here is that there are two concepts of witnesses. There are witnesses to tell us what happened, to clarify, to verify, to describe, to tell us what happened. That's one type of witnesses. Then there are witnesses which are an integral component of a transaction, a legal, halachic transaction. It needs witnesses. Without witnesses, there is no transaction. There's no marriage without witnesses, even if everybody admits. But if A lends B money and they both admit to the terms and they both admit the amount of money, that's fine. We don't need witnesses for that. Okay? So now let's get back to our Mishnah over here. And now I think the mystery will be removed as to why we have this strange kind of an order over here. First, we have the witnesses testify using the name Josie when they describe what happened. And then the Sanhedrin goes into all kinds of investigations, investigating the testimonies of the witnesses and the cross-examination, and then investigating the halachic aspects and every possible aspect. And the Sanhedrin always tries to find an out. I mean, that's what they're... They must try to find a way out for the person, try to save the person as much as they can, if it's all possible, to find the halachic way out. Maybe he didn't say this properly, maybe he didn't hear the enunciation, all kinds of possibilities. And then they go through this lengthy investigation, but then right before the conclusion, after the vote is guilty, so then what they do is they have to have one of the witnesses state the curse actually the way he heard it, not using the word Josie, but using the word God replacing Josie. Okay? Now, why is this so? The reason is as follows. The witnesses over here serve two functions. One function of the witnesses is to bring the information to the Sanhedrin. Okay. Now, when they bring the information to the Sanhedrin, so in being informative, they don't need to use God's name, because when they use the word Josie, we know it's a clear-cut reference to God's name, and as I mentioned before, it has the numerical value of the name of Almighty, and it's a four-letter word, so it's a word that is clear in the minds of the witnesses that this word stands for God. They know that, and there's no question about that. So in terms of giving us information, when they use the word Josie, it's fine. This is embedded in their minds clearly that this word stands for God. And therefore, whenever the Sanhedrin questions them, their testimony is acceptable, because we know what they're talking about, and we know what they're saying. So in order to investigate the area as witnesses who are conveying information, using the word Josie is fine. But then there is another halachic obligation, and that is that before the verdict is sealed, before the sealing of the verdict, you must have the witness give an actual description. Now, this is not simply because we want to know what happened. This is just like those two witnesses that you have by the marriage ceremony, which means that they must be there. They're a component, a necessary component of the marriage. If they're not there, there is no marriage. Similarly, over here, you cannot have any kind of carrying out, any kind of verdict cannot take place unless a witness actually states formally exactly what he heard without using any kind of substitution. This is necessary, because if this is not done, then you have not fulfilled the halachic requirement of the judicial system, and you cannot enact the verdict. You can't pronounce the verdict. The verdict, you cannot carry out the execution. So therefore, in order for the verdict to be sealed, what is required is the testimony of the witnesses. Over here, we don't require the testimony in order to give us information. The halacha demands an actual statement by the witnesses as to what exactly they saw, and it must be verbalized exactly. No substitution, no changes, even though we know what those changes are. The verbalization itself is what is necessary. That is the halacha. Just like the halacha states you must have two witnesses by a marriage ceremony, the halacha states in a court of law you cannot seal the verdict, the fate of an individual, unless the witness enunciates verbally exactly what he saw. Now, the reason why the Sanhedrin didn't have the witnesses do that at first is very simple. Because let us say the Sanhedrin would decide that this person is innocent. So then it would come out that these witnesses enunciated the name of God in vain. There was no reason for them to say it. Okay? So therefore, at first they would use the word Josie in order to avoid enunciating the prohibited blasphemous curse. So they would use a word which gave the Sanhedrin all the information so that they can start their investigative process and thoroughly go through the matter according to all the requirements. Now, once, if the man was guilty, most of the Sanhedrin thought him guilty, then before they could actually perform an execution, it was necessary for the witnesses to enunciate precisely what they heard. Because without that enunciation, the Torah states, without the clear statement of the witnesses, the Torah states, you cannot enact a verdict. So the sealing, the conclusion of the verdict, can only take place with this formal statement on the part of the witnesses. It's necessary not for clarification. It's necessary because that's what the Torah mandates, that the statement of the witness must be made exactly as he saw it. Okay? So this is why you had, in this case, you had this strange procedure where Josie was used at first for clarification purposes, but then before the enactment of the law, before the law is enacted, you must fulfill that requirement of having the witnesses make their statement exactly. And if they don't make the statement exactly, there is no enacting of the law. So that was saved for later, after we see that he is guilty. Then we have to have the witnesses make that statement, and thereby they fulfill the second requirement of witnesses. Now you should realize that in every case, whenever a witness bears testimony in an ordinary case, not in a case like this, his first statements satisfy two things. They give information to the Sanhedrin, A, and also they function as the condemning statement of the witnesses. In other words, before a man is, his verdict is finalized, before the enactment of the guilty verdict, there must be a condemning statement of the witnesses. The condemning statement of the witnesses has to be exact, and it can't be, you can't use substitution because that's not the condemning statement. The condemning statement must be full, real, exact, the way he heard it. He must give an exact description. And if it's not exact, then it's worthless. So you could substitute when it comes to analysis, but you can't substitute when it comes to enactment of verdict. And that's why, in this case, at first they would have the witness to substitute, because they don't want to say God's name for no reason at all, if it turned out that the man is innocent. But if the man is guilty, then it was necessary to have the condemning statement of the witnesses made using the full curse, which would be include the name of God. And now we have an interesting thing. If you look at the Mishnah says that only one of the witnesses would make the statement, and the second witness would say, I too heard just as he did. In other words, A would say it, and B would not repeat it again. B would simply say, I heard it exactly as A heard it. Okay? So the Talmud deduces from this, you see, that you must say, the Talmud says, that this would be valid in every case. Because, in other words, let's say, for instance, if you had a murder case, so they say A murdered B. So the witnesses would say, the first witness would say, A murdered B. Now they ask the second witness, what did you see? He could also say, I saw the same as A. But that was never really done. They would always ask the second witness would always say, they'd ask him to say it on his own. They wouldn't say, they wouldn't accept that. I mean, technically it would be okay. They wouldn't accept it. Let me get back technically. They wouldn't accept it because they'd ask the second witness to enunciate exactly what he saw. Exactly what he saw. Why is it in this case that it is okay for B to say, I saw exactly as I heard the exact same thing as A? So the Talmud explains that the reason that we see from this that it's not necessary for each witness to verbalize himself the condemning statement. He could say, that's exactly what I heard, and that's enough. But why don't you do it in other cases? The reason is because we always try as much as we can for clarification. And there's always more clarification when a person uses his own words. That is in the Torah it says, in Deuteronomy it states, that when about the courts, it says, and you shall investigate, and you shall search, and you shall investigate very well, the Torah says. So the court is obligated to do the most thorough investigation possible. And that is why, in ordinary cases, we don't allow a witness to say, well, I heard or saw that exact same thing, but we demand his own words, because when a person uses their own words, there is more clarification. However, in this case, we cannot clarify any further, because we're limited by the prohibition of enunciating the curse, because one is not permitted to enunciate the curse. So therefore, the Sanhedrin has fulfilled its responsibility by the moment the second witness says, I heard exactly as the first witness says. In this case, they cannot go any further, and they can't have that additional kind of crystal clear clarification, because they must be satisfied with the minimal that the halacha recognizes as valid. They can't go for more over here because of the fact that they can't enunciate the name of God in that, and certainly not in that manner. So even the enunciation of God's name alone is prohibited. So therefore, in this case,
Rabbi, we have one minute.
Okay. So therefore, in this case, the second witness says, it is fine for the second witness to say, I heard exactly as the first witness did. This is considered valid, condemning testimony. And both witnesses have fulfilled their obligation to make the condemning statement before the enactment of the verdict. You cannot enact a verdict unless you have the official condemning statement of the witnesses. That official statement must be clear and exact, and does not tolerate any substitution. Whereas for the clarification process, substitution is fine. So substitution is used initially, and then after the investigation, the official condemning statement of the witnesses is made before the enactment of the verdict. Okay, we'll stop here.